This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Brian Larson. Colorado is known as a welcoming place for the LGBTQ community, but it hasn't always been that way.
It's taken us a long time to get to where we are, but that's because we've had to be awakened so quickly.
Ahead of Denver Pride, we look at how the hate state was transformed into a leader in equal rights. Also, when young people move away from their rural community, regaining that population can be impossible.
We do have quite a few things for being such a small town, but it's still not enough, I guess, to keep some of the younger crowd here.
We'll have another story in our occasional series looking at the growing pains facing Colorado communities.
And later, we'll explore a program that teaches athlete-level physical conditioning for musicians, plus a review of the new movie, Fall of the American Empire.
But first, Governor Jared Polis has issued an executive order designed to address Colorado's poor vaccination rates for kindergarten students and other children.
Federal health officials say the country is experiencing the largest outbreak of measles since 1992. Now, Polis is not mandating vaccines. He wants a public education campaign for parents with vaccine hesitancy and incentives for doctors offering immunizations.
We really view this as the third way between the government forcing people to get shots, which is counterproductive, and simply allowing these rates to go down, which is counterproductive to the public health and will result in people dying.
During the legislative session, Polis threatened to veto a proposal that would have made it harder for parents to opt their kids out of vaccinations.
School administrators are exploring the possibility of tearing down and rebuilding Columbine High School. That's been prompted by a recent increase in unauthorized people coming to the school.
Now, the idea is that the building's history attracts people. Jefferson County School Superintendent Jason Glass says the number of such visitors has gone up, especially over the past 2 years. In fact, during the last school year, more than 2,400 people were contacted on the Columbine school grounds.
The proposal is still in its early stages. Administrators are collecting feedback on it through an online survey.
This week, an effort to recall a Colorado Democratic lawmaker over his support for gun control came to an end. Tom Sullivan voted for an extreme risk protection order bill, or so-called red flag bill, during the legislative session. The governor has since signed that into law. Members of a gun rights group, Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, were among those who filed a recall petition against Sullivan in May. They had until July 12th to collect the needed signatures, just over 10,000, to get the recall on the ballot. Now, I talked with KUNC's State Capitol reporter Scott Franz and our Guns in America reporter Lee Patterson, who have both been following this story. Now, Scott, you tagged along with Tom Sullivan as he went door-to-door campaigning.
Right. He was spending evenings and weekends doing this, essentially having to go through his district just like he did last fall. I actually had a hard time keeping up with him. We spent about an hour going door-to-door, and he mostly got positive receptions from the voters who he spoke with, saying that, you know, they elected him to do what he was doing. On the car ride back, I asked him how he was holding up during the recall effort, which, you know, for a lawmaker can be a very stressful time.
I know we're on the right side of this. I know that this is what needs to be done. I mean, they've never met someone, you know, like me. And I'm not going to, you know, get bullied. I'm not going to get pushed around.
Sullivan's son, Alex, was killed in the 2012 Aurora Theater shooting, which is why he ran for office in the first place. And so I called him right after it was announced that this recall is over.
This is a huge day. I mean, no one has ever stopped one of these recalls before. We're the first ones. Okay? We stopped this dead in its tracks. And it's not going to go on anymore.
Now, the move to recall Sullivan didn't sit well with some Republicans. Lee, you looked into that part of the story.
Right, yeah. So there's some important context here. So last November, Sullivan, who's a Democrat, beat the Republican incumbent Cole Wist in the HD 37 race to represent the Arapahoe County area. Before Wist lost re-election, he had co-sponsored an extreme risk protection order bill that failed during that legislative session. Sullivan co-sponsored a very similar extreme risk protection order bill. So this type of legislation would likely be familiar to constituents and supported by many of them. Yet the effort to get rid of Sullivan largely focused on this extreme risk law. I spoke with Laura Carno about this. She's the executive director of FASTER. That's an organization that trains armed school staff. And Carno played an active role in another recall back in 2013 over gun bills that were passed after the Aurora Theater shooting.
It absolutely seemed like a long shot. I joined the effort because it was the right thing to do. Citizens should always feel comfortable saying to their politicians, don't you dare, or you can go this far and no further.
Carno says that neither lawmaker ran on gun control, and then they supported bills that she called extreme. This time around, with this recall, Carno says that things are different.
He said, I'm running for office. I'm going to offer and pass every gun control bill I possibly can. Although I don't agree with him on anything. None of his votes do I agree with. The people of that district voted for him knowing all of that.
Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, that's the group that backed the recall specifically because of gun rights issues, didn't respond to our request for comment on this story. On Facebook, the group's executive director, his name is Dudley Brown, did post, quote, Tom Sullivan's socialist voting record and radically anti-gun positions will be a central discussion piece of the 2020 general election.
Now, Scott, we'll let you have the final word. What does Tom Sullivan do now that the recall is over?
Well, Sullivan says he has time to take a deep breath, relax, take a break. He's got his Wednesday evenings back, his weekends back. But he's really looking forward to the upcoming legislative session. There are issues, veterans' rights, he says, workers' rights, other things that he wants to tackle. And he's excited now that, you know, he has the freedom to focus on governing and policy rather than going door to door again in a campaign style effort.
One of the country's largest pride parades will wind through the streets of Denver this weekend, and the Grand Marshal is the first openly gay governor in U.S. history. As KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, it's seen as a symbol of hard-won tolerance for LGBTQ residents in what used to be known as the hate state.
Last month, on the steps of the state capitol, Governor Jared Polis addressed a cheerful crowd of LGBTQ rights advocates.
All right, welcome everybody.
They were there watching him sign a statewide ban on conversion therapy. The practice is used to change a person from gay to straight.
Not only is there no evidence whatsoever that anybody can change their sexual orientation, but in fact, many of these so-called therapies or treatments are counterproductive.
It was hailed as a big win for the community, which hasn't always felt at home in Colorado.
In just 27 years, we've had a remarkable transformation from what was derogatorily called the hate state to a place where the rights of all Coloradans are respected.
But things were much different leading up to the 1992 election.
Colorado's Amendment 2 says the state could not have any law where homosexual, lesbian or bisexual orientation is the basis of any protected status or claim of discrimination.
A group in Colorado Springs called Colorado for Family Values ran the ballot measure in direct opposition to cities like Denver and Boulder that had passed local anti-discrimination laws. Equal rights groups led an aggressive No on Two campaign, which included Glenda Russell, a psychologist from Louisville.
And we started driving toward Denver. It was snowing. It was crappy weather.
On election night, she and her partner attended the watch party. They were optimistic it would fail. But when the results came in, the room fell silent. Amendment 2 won with 53% of the vote.
I started crying because even though I had expected it, you expect lots of things to happen. But when you fully are sure they're going to happen, when they happen, there's still a psychological hit.
Immediately after, calls for a boycott of Colorado came from around the country, as did the now famous hate state epithet. That's when Russell started studying the social and psychological impact it had on the community.
People had a sense of what I called psychic homelessness, like I used to feel safe here, this used to be where I lived, now I don't feel like this is my state anymore.
Even though the measure had negative impacts, she says it also led to something positive.
So you've had incredible mobilization of political groups all over the state. Some people estimate over 100 political groups got born.
It was the day gay rights groups in Colorado and across the country were waiting for.
After court battles, a challenge to Amendment 2's constitutionality eventually made it to the Supreme Court in 1996. And it was struck down.
The first Supreme Court decision ever upholding gay rights.
At that point, is Colorado still the hate state in people's minds?
I wouldn't say so. That's David Duffield. He's a historian with the Colorado LGBT History Project.
So after 96, I mean, it was a very, we entered this period of quiescence, or of quietness.
The activists working to overturn Amendment 2 needed a new place to channel all their momentum. And wealthy donors started pouring money into candidates and political organizations supporting a nationwide movement for marriage equality.
People were working towards slow incremental steps to create a bridge between the rights that married people have and the 1,157 rights that queer people couldn't have under the law then.
One example was a state referendum in 2006 to create domestic partnerships for same-sex couples.
I'm sick of all the negative ads.
John Hickenlooper was mayor of Denver at the time.
And then vote yes on referendum I. It's not marriage. It's basic legal rights.
But it was defeated with 52% of the vote.
It was finally passed in 2008, and it established at a state level domestic partnerships and protections for all people. The next logical step was civil unions.
That was the legal recognition of a relationship similar to marriage, but without the title and federal benefits. That same year, the legislature passed statewide LGBTQ non-discrimination laws. Voters also elected one of the first openly gay state senators, Pat Stedman.
Colleagues, thank you for this debate.
Along with other members of the LGBT caucus, Stedman worked to legalize civil unions. In this 2012 Senate floor speech, he's flanked by hundreds of handwritten cards against what he was doing.
I don't care how tall this stack of postcards grows, because in my mind, it is outweighed by this one book that I'm going to set right here. That's the Colorado Constitution and the United States Constitutions.
Lawmakers killed the bill that year, but a similar version passed in 2013. Then Governor John Hickenlooper signed civil unions into law in front of a roaring crowd. Despite the momentum, it took a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2015 to fully legalize same-sex marriage in most states, including Colorado.
It was like living in a very fast-paced river. Everything was changing constantly.
David Duffield says Colorado is still feeling the aftershocks of overturning Amendment 2. Last year, voters made history by electing the country's first openly gay governor. They also elected the state's first openly transgender representative.
It's taken us a long time to get to where we are, but that's because we've had to be awakened so quickly through so many different things.
During last month's bill signing, Governor Polis also made note of another piece of legislation he was putting his name on.
We're also signing a bill called Jude's Law.
Named after a local student, the bill makes it easier for transgender residents to change the gender marker on their birth certificate or driver's license.
Jude testified not only this year, but when she was even younger. How old were you when you started testifying for this bill?
I was 9.
When she was 9 years old, and we know how intimidating that can be.
And so does Daniel Ramos.
Yeah, personally, I've seen a lot of change.
Ramos is standing in line for a piece of rainbow cake that was being served at the ceremony.
I came out in Northeast Colorado in Sterling at the age of 13, and a lot of folks didn't understand what being LGBTQ meant.
And now as the director of the advocacy group One Colorado, he says Colorado's a leading state for equal rights under the law, but adds that laws can only do so much.
We're finding that people are experiencing more discrimination on the street, in their schools, at their workplace, and even in their houses of worship. And so now is a rally cry.
In other words, there's more work to be done. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
Denver Pride Fest kicks off in Civic Center Park Saturday morning, June 15th. The parade is on Sunday. Organizers expect more than 400,000 people to attend.
You're a musician, Brian, right? You play guitar?
Yeah, I guess you could say that or call it that.
When you pick it up, you
right,
know.
Right.
All right, so I'm curious, what advice would you give musicians who want to become great at their instrument?
It is not going to happen overnight, so practice, practice, practice.
Lots of practice. Well, apparently you also need to add in a little time at the gym to that list.
It's something that a lot of people in the general population don't really quite understand about musicians, that we do things that are athletic in nature.
Coming up, we'll hear about a CU program that keeps musicians physically in tune.
Cool. But before we get to that, Colorado is growing. The population continues to swell in Front Range communities like Denver, Fort Collins, and Greeley. But growth is impacting rural parts of the state differently. A recent study by New Hampshire University found some areas are actually losing people. KUNC's Esther Honig traveled to a town in the most northeastern corner of the state where that's happening.
The D&J Cafe is a classic small-town diner, serving plates of biscuits and gravy and mugs of hot coffee. It's really the only restaurant in Julesburg, so they have a lot of regulars.
I can be cooking on the line and they can hang tickets and I don't even have to look out into the restaurant and I just know whose food it is that I'm cooking.
That's Tasha Harris. She and her husband Joe opened the cafe in 2016. Harris and her husband met here while in high school and moved away together to Denver. But they came back a few years later to raise a family. Harris knows of others who have done the same, but some people have left for good.
We do have quite a few things for being such a small town, but it's still not enough, I guess, to keep some of the younger crowd here.
It's a concept known as outward migration. And according to Kenneth Johnson, many small towns in America have seen most of their young people leave. Johnson is a demographer with New Hampshire University.
It's not uncommon in rural high schools for half of the graduating class to leave the area within a few years after graduation. And that didn't just happen once or twice. That happened decade after decade.
Johnson studied census data dating back to the 1900s and found this is especially acute in agricultural towns like Julesburg. He says modern farming, which is so heavily mechanized, doesn't offer many jobs.
Eventually, there just aren't many young people left to produce a new generation.
Julesburg is in Sedgwick County, which according to census data has been shrinking, albeit slowly, for decades. Once this trend starts, Johnson says it's hard to reverse.
It's quiet and peaceful. We have great schools, great hospital.
Donald Schneider is a Sedgwick County commissioner. He and I walk along the main street in Julesburg, which has a century-old movie theater. Schneider says this is the ideal place to raise a family.
We're only 35 miles from any really major shopping if you wanted to go to a big Walmart or Cabela's or whatnot like that.
A full-time farmer, Schneider ran for office in 2016 to see if he could help out his community. He knew the population was smaller than it used to be, but what he didn't realize is how big of a budget crisis the county was facing.
We've been trying not to cut any jobs.
While tax revenues have stayed relatively the same, the costs of running the county have gone up.
We have a hiring freeze and a wage freeze right now, trying to get our budget balanced.
About a third of rural counties in the U.S. are facing depopulation. Kenneth Johnson says there's no easy solution, but his study does make a recommendation: embracing recent immigrants. And that's playing out in nearby Morgan County. In Fort Morgan, Columbine Elementary has hired more teachers as the student body continues to grow. What you're hearing is their new Spanish immersion program.
And it's called a two-way program because a third of the kids already speak the language and they're here to support the non-Spanish speakers.
Principal Nicholas Ng says there's about 8 different languages spoken in his school. These are children of immigrants and refugees from all over the world, many of whom came here to work at the Cargill meatpacking plant.
We're lucky. We're really quite a healthy community, economically and culturally.
Fort Morgan has seen waves of growth in the last 2 decades. These newcomers tend to be younger, contribute to the local economy, and have a higher birth rate. But what does that mean for towns like Julesburg?
We have 2 interstates right close by. There should be no reason why we couldn't attract some new business.
Donald Schneider hopes to bring in a new truck stop, maybe even a motel, to boost jobs and revenue. As is, they've had to cut back on local services. The DMV, for example, no longer offers driving tests.
There's really nothing else that we could do. You know, we have to start looking at everything that's costing money or is not bringing in any money.
In the meantime, he and others will keep exploring their options. Esther Honig, KUNC, Julesburg.
You can check out more from our occasional series, Growing Pains, at our website, kunc.org.
For college athletes, there's a lot of focus on keeping physically fit and recovering from injuries when they happen. Coaches, trainers, physical therapists. At the University of Colorado Boulder, there's a similar program, but for musicians.
What?
KUNC Arts reporter Stacy Nick has more.
Just like.
Yeah. Don't play that. Doctor, it hurts when I do that. Well, don't do that.
It's an old joke CU Oboe Professor James Brody is referencing. Today, he's working with grad student Brittany Bonner, but the focus is less on how her playing sounds and more on how her playing feels.
Since I've moved here, with the altitude, I realized that it was really hard to feel like I had enough air to blow out in order to play the oboe.
In 2003, Brody helped start the Musicians Wellness Program, along with a series of classes. The program uses a method called the Alexander Technique, which focuses on changing repetitive movements and posture to avoid injury and maintain peak performance.
And it's something that a lot of people in the general population don't really quite understand about musicians, that we do things that are athletic in nature.
Brody's office almost looks more like a gym. Yoga balls, mats, and foam rollers set against one wall, while another is lined with floor-to-ceiling mirrors.
We do a lot of muscular activity, and it's completely possible to get injured from that.
When she started playing the oboe back in sixth grade, Brittany Bonner says she was like most musicians.
It was just pick up the instrument and play, and everything's new, bright, and shiny, and fun.
While preparing for an upcoming solo recital, she noticed soreness in her shoulders and hands. Turns out the fix was easier than she thought.
What I realized was that a source of my tension while I was playing in my hands was that I felt like I couldn't get my lower register to respond. And I felt like I was trying to fix the tension in my hand, fix so many things. But then I realized, well, if I made a reed that was easier to blow through to play on, then I won't feel as much tension in my arm.
Every instrument has its issues. You know, for example, a violist who just fell in love with the instrument, but maybe a little bit small of stature and not able to make that stretch as easily.
Oddly enough, one of the most common injuries Brody sees comes not from the larger instruments like the tuba or the trombone, but from the humble flute.
Playing the flute is not a terribly natural activity.
Nicole Peters knows that all too well. After her first semester of college, the 19-year-old flute major began suffering from tendonitis in her shoulder due to the more than 6 hours a day she commits to playing. Now a sophomore, Peters uses the techniques from the program to get her to her ultimate goal, playing in the orchestra pit of a Broadway musical.
I'd like to continue playing for as long as I physically can, and I hope to make that many, many years, because nothing makes me happier.
The idea of wellness extends beyond just aches and pains. It also includes hearing tests and mental health counseling to address stress, depression, and anxiety. But it goes beyond the old advice of picturing the audience naked to get over stage fright.
Wouldn't that be horrifying? Playing to a naked audience.
Matthew Tomatz is a psychotherapist at CU's Counseling and Psychiatric Services. He works with the program.
But by thinking about vulnerability and what it means to actually be with the audience, to connect with them, to express to them, and to lead them in an experience, then it starts to make vulnerability less threatening.
While focusing on musicians' health might seem odd, James Brody says it's a concept more universities are adding. Even the National Association of Schools of Music recently changed its guidelines from suggesting a wellness component to mandating it. As we walk down a hallway filled with rehearsal studios, Brody returned to that earlier comparison of musicians to athletes, noting that much like a strong athletic program, the Musicians Wellness Program has helped CU's music school attract and retain its star players.
Just as, say, the basketball team, if somebody goes down, if one of the key players goes down, then the team's going to suffer. If one of our key orchestral members goes down, that situation's going to suffer as well.
Ultimately, he hopes students training to become music teachers will take the lessons into their classrooms, preparing the next generation of musicians. Stacy Nick, KUNC, Boulder.
The Musicians Wellness Program is part of CU's $57 million expansion to its Warner & Meig Music Building, opening in summer 2020.
The movie The Fall of the American Empire tells a story about a dopey man and a prostitute. For KUNC film critic Howie Moshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the genius of this film is that both of them matter.
Pierre-Paul Alexandre Landry could be the most worried-looking guy in the history of the movies. At the start of Denis Arcand's The Fall of the American Empire, he's obsessed with the problem that he's too intelligent. People who are less intelligent than he is have no problem following their self-interest and becoming rich or famous or whatever. As Pierre-Paul explains this to his then-girlfriend, she walks out on him. For all his hapless foolishness, Pierre-Paul is kind and generous. He volunteers in a soup kitchen. He gives money to homeless people on the street. For work, he delivers packages, but he is terminally naive, and he really has no money to give away. Until he happens upon a robbery in progress that's gone bad. Two big bags of money are lying in front of him in a parking lot with no one around. And what follows is a story that's part farce, part touching moral drama, and full-out fantasy. French-Canadian filmmaker Denis Arcand's been making moral dramas since the 1980s with his two best-known movies, The Decline of the American Empire and Jesus of Montreal. But The Fall of the American Empire may be his most fluid and graceful film. As a side note, when Arcand uses the word America, he's not thinking of the United States. Canada is a big chunk of North America. Pierre-Paul has no idea of what to do with this ton of money that fell into his lap. He's also too dumb in the ways of crime and criminals to realize that the people who believe the money is theirs are not good people. And he also doesn't stop to think that perhaps the police might also be interested in what happened and where the money might have gone. Pierre-Paul's first clueless step is to hire the most expensive prostitute in Montreal, who turns out to be far more than the cliched hooker with a heart of gold. Aspasi, Marie-Pierre Morin, is just as smart, generous, sensible, and perceptive as Pierre-Paul is dense. They take walks together and talk all night long until you figure that her business must be going to pot. A second stroke of luck comes in the form of Sylvain, a master crook just out of prison, who also has no malice in him. It's hard to find a movie that's simultaneously kind, moral, and witty. A surveillance cop falls asleep on the job. Pierre-Paul chooses Aspasi in the first place because Aspasi is the name of a friend of Socrates, and she can quote the French writer Racine. When Aspasi confesses that she feels intellectually shallow, Pierre-Paul counters that he has a PhD in philosophy and can provide the depth for the two of them. True to dorky form, Pierre-Paul is dead serious. It's, of course, a male fantasy, this gentle, wise prostitute who makes everything good for an inept guy. But The Fall of the American Empire goes way beyond Pretty Woman with its movie star prostitute who apparently never has or will do an actual trick. All through the movie, Aspasi and Pierre-Paul bump into her satisfied clients. She gets texts and calls late at night. But she slowly grows fond of her needy little man, who never in the movie shows a spark of savvy. Ultimately, The Fall of the American Empire is a love story and a caper movie, but the usual terms are folded inside out. You figure out where it's going, but the journey's so full of humanity that it's just fine. And it's a wonderful break from the harsh fantasies that careen off movie screens, full of hostility, death, an astonishing lack of respect for the audience. But The Fall of the American Empire is not mush. It's a moral drama that makes both characters and audience consider how we behave in the world. And it's fun. For KUNC, I'm Howie Moshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible, as always, with support from our KUNC members. If you enjoy listening and you're not a member, you can support our work with a gift anytime you like at KUNC.org. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Brian Larson. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with Ashley Jeffcoat, who manages digital. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
We also heard Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. If you like what you're hearing, you can subscribe to Colorado Edition so you never miss an episode. Do that at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.